Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, the economic cost of war. New research suggests Lebanon's GDP could shrink by over 20% amid the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. As the US election hots up, we'll look at the cost of healthcare and how it might determine how people vote.
The price might be double or even triple. Here, you can look at a filling for 800, 900 pesos. And in the US, it might be $300, $400.
And find out why a Tasmanian ferry takes an unexpected berth more than 10,500 miles away in Edinburgh.
I think the main reaction here has been bemusement and bewilderment. How did anyone in charge of the project not realise that it wasn't going to happen?
That's all to come here on World Business Report. We start in Lebanon, where explosions have been heard across the south of the country on Thursday. There are reports also that a Hezbollah attack on the border town of Metula in northern Israel killed at least five people, including an Israeli farmer. The conflict escalated significantly on October 1st. That's when Israel launched a widespread bombing campaign across Lebanon, followed by a limited ground invasion. This was part of the ongoing Israel-Hezbollah conflict. Sally Hayden is the Irish Times correspondent in Beirut. She told me that the attacks are severely impacting Lebanon's economy.
Israeli assault is continuing. Yesterday, there was an evacuation warning issued for the entire eastern city of Baalbek. And the reports we've heard is that there were then more than 20 strikes there yesterday, tens of thousands of people fleeing. And Baalbek, I'm sure people know, includes a UNESCO heritage site, kind of ancient Roman temple complex. But there's also strikes continuing elsewhere in the south. The ancient city of Tyre, the fifth largest city in Lebanon, has been badly damaged this week with further strikes. Evacuation orders were also issued for a large portion of that city. And generally, yeah, just more displacement and more, airstrikes.
You're talking to us today from Beirut, but can you describe some of the impact that this has had so far on infrastructure? What sort of things have you seen?
It's Beirut's southern suburbs that's been hit the hardest. And I've driven around there a few times in the past week, and the destruction is really just unbelievable. You know, buildings that have been leveled. It's pretty hard to get full access there because Hezbollah controls that area, particularly at the moment. And so especially as a journalist, you're kind of limited in what you can do. But the destruction is very clear to see. And at the same stage, I mean, from an economic perspective, it's interesting that there are people who have jobs who are still trying to do them for as long as they can. So often there'll be people who have sent out, you know, their families, particularly men I've seen staying behind and trying to continue their work even when their wives and their children are gone. And they're the ones often who are getting impacted when there are further strikes.
That was reporter for the Irish Times, Sally Hayden, speaking to us from Beirut. Well, new research highlights the potential scale of the damage. Analysis from one of the largest humanitarian organisations, Mercy Corps, suggests that the size of Lebanon's economy could contract nearly 13% if the attacks continue. If the conflict escalates, that figure could rise to more than 20%. Mercy Corps' Lebanon country director, Leila Alamine, tells me how they came up with those two figures.
For the first scenario, what we did is that we combined two figures, one being the contraction of the GDP in the productive sector, which is estimated to be around 5.83, as well as a contraction of the GDP in the service sector, which is almost 7%. So combined together, we reach this figure of 12.8 contraction of the GDP in the next 4 months, which is an equivalent of approximately a bit over $2.3 billion. And in this specific sectors, it means more unemployment, it means lower wages, it means also less production in the agricultural sector, which means increased food insecurity as well.
In the second scenario, you've projected an economic contraction of nearly 22% of GDP. Explain that and explain what sectors will be hardest hit.
Assuming that most of the conflict will continue to be in the Beka and South area, the sectors that will be most hit are agriculture, manufacturing, services, utilities. Again, it's an accumulation of the different sectors combined, and we reach almost 22%.
Given that agriculture contributes 80% of South Lebanon's economy, how are local farmers coping at the moment with the disruptions caused by the conflict?
This is the category of people who are in the worst situation, really, because these farmers in South Lebanon have lost already 2 years of harvest. Because their specialty is olive groves. And so already last year, after October 7, the harvest of olives is usually in October. So they lost last year's harvest, and now they're losing again this year. So they're actually not coping at all. They're surviving from different assistance they're receiving from families, local networks, or organizations on the ground, charities, etc.
How are they feeling on the ground? Because you speak to these people, don't you?
There is a lot of frustration, a lot of despair from people who are civilians caught in the conflict, who have been already submitted to so many shocks with the economic crisis, the 2006 war. So it's basically one shock after the other. And now that they have lost all their incomes, they don't see how they will be able to recover from this in the coming years.
Should we talk about tourism as well? Because that sector contributed about 30% of Lebanon's GDP in 2023. The projected loss there is about $1.2 billion. What steps are being taken to mitigate its collapse?
This is indeed a huge concern, because Lebanon has always been very reliant on its diaspora, who contributes to most of the tourism in Lebanon, especially around Christmas and in summer. And so there was last Christmas, there was already the conflict, and then the summer with the escalation, and probably next Christmas, we don't know yet. But really, it has been a sector that is very hard to hit. And like, you have dozens of thousands of families who live from it, whether in the hospitality sector, in the agricultural sector. And then in the longer term, we will need economic recovery programs, because again, even if the conflict stops now, things will not resume as they were before just overnight.
What about the destruction of infrastructure, shipping, ports, roads, rail, that kind of thing? Because that can really be very, very costly to rebuild.
Our estimation so far is that the bill will be between 2.8 billion and 3.7 billion. But of course, it depends how the situation will evolve in the coming weeks. We've been doing an assessment of the damages in the south, and yeah, our estimation is that it will be over 3 billion.
In terms of the displacement of people, in your research, how costly is that to the economy?
So it is very difficult to estimate the cost for this because it's still ongoing. So we're talking mostly people who lost their jobs, right? Because we're talking a lot of farmers, of local shopkeepers, etc. And we don't have an estimation of the economic damage, but what we know is that these people will not be able to return to their villages because entire villages have been wiped out. And so there will be a huge economic loss because they are not able to resume their daily activities and they remain in need of assistance.
I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to say, but people have lost absolutely everything.
Absolutely. They've lost everything. Lebanon is not a highly digitized country. So these are not digital nomads, right? They are farmers. They had their olive groves or orchards. And when they lost their home and their agricultural activities, they've lost everything. And some of them had to flee overnight, fleeing the bombs, like with only their clothes on their back. So they are really restarting from scratch.
Leila Alamine there speaking to me from Lebanon. She's the country director for Lebanon for Mercy Corps. The oil and gas company Shell is cutting back on its investment in renewable energy projects despite reporting billions in profits. Shell's spending on oil exploration and drilling is nearly five times higher than its investment in renewables. On Thursday, the energy company announced third quarter profits of $6 billion. That was exceeding forecasts of 12%, as higher LNG gas sales offset a significant decline in oil refining and trading results. Well, let's talk to Emma Wall about this. She's head of investment analysis and research at Hargreaves Lansdown. So, Emma, these results are significantly different, aren't they, to BP's results, which came out earlier in the week. It reported its weakest quarterly profits in almost 4 years.
Yeah, Shell's share price has bounced more than 3% in intraday trading, because you're right, the underlying earnings have significantly beat expectations. So $6 billion for the quarter against an expectation of $5.4 billion. And also debt has fallen as well by $3.1 billion. I mean, this is a continuation of a theme. You know, Shell's significant third quarter beat is sort of this better than expected results. It's all about the focus on the financials. And Shell has been very good at this year to date. But the renewables, as you say, is this is one little sort of marker, actually. It's the one area of the business that isn't doing as well as expected. And we haven't had a huge amount of detail of what the capex on renewables will be in the full year, but they have said it won't be as expected. Now, there's two ways of looking at this. You know, it has been a very strong year for oil. It's been a strong couple of years for oil. So ultimately, the reason why Shell is doing well is that makes up the bulk of its business. But renewables have to be in the mix for long-term sustainable growth and revenues. So for my team, for equity analysts, we're looking at, right, what's the mix here where oil is delivering now in terms of revenues and profits, but longer term, that focus on renewables is really key.
Yeah, at the moment, they're saying that oil exploration and drilling, they're spending more on that. They're in that and their investment in renewables. So in terms of that mix, it looks like the mix is heading towards more fossil fuels than renewables.
Ultimately, this is about supply and demand. And, you know, unfortunately, because of some of the concerns in the Middle East, there is a supply-demand issue here for oil, which means it's favourable for that part of the business. You know, oil prices are high and they are volatile, and we do expect for them to remain high into 2025. So in the near term, that focus on oil is good for business, just good for the pure kind of underlying revenues and profits. But as I say, longer term, you need to have that focus mix with renewables for sustainable growth.
Emma Wall, thank you for the time being. We'll talk to you again later in the programme. You're listening to World Business Report on the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. Now, let's take a look at some crucial economic data from the US now, with the election just days away. This information is more important than ever. Now, earlier today, the Federal Reserve's preferred gauge of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, was released, and it shows that inflation slowed to 2.1%, down from 2.2% in August. So that's essentially on the financial reserves target rate of 2%. The BBC's North America business correspondent Ritika Gupta joins us now to break down these figures and tell us what it means for the economy and the upcoming election. Remind us, first of all, what is PCE inflation?
So the PCE data, this is the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. And as you mentioned, it ticked up some 0.2% in the month of September, and that was as expected. But overall, the headline inflation rose at a 2.1% annual rate. And that's the lowest since early 2021 and just above the central bank's 2% goal. So we're moving towards that target. But the core figure, that excludes the volatile food and energy prices, that rose 0.3% in September and 2.7% year over year. So just a little bit above expectations on the core figure.
And when the Federal Reserve decide on interest rates, they look at lots of different figures, don't they?
Yes, and that's why this data is really important, because it will impact the Federal Reserve and its decision on interest rate cuts, which when it meets next week. And the Federal Reserve, yes, as you mentioned, it looks at many things, but it has a dual mandate. So the Fed focuses on both employment and inflation data here in the US. So if we look at the data today and overall the data that we've had in the past week on the economic side, it's painted a picture of overall resilience in the US economy. So in theory, that would allow the Fed to cut interest rates another quarter point at its meeting next week. And that's what the markets are broadly expecting. And we know last meeting that the Federal Reserve had, it put an end to its longest cycle of interest rate hikes in roughly a decade. So we know cutting borrower costs, that can boost the economy, it can impact hiring, inflation, the housing market. But as we know, that can take time to filter through to the economy. So consumers don't necessarily feel that impact right away.
Well, let's hear from some of those consumers now. The economic news doesn't directly translate into political outcomes, as many Americans are still smarting from price increases over the past 2 years.
And even my parents are paying ridiculously high prices for car insurance. I'm paying even more than them because I'm a younger age. And so it's just having to deal with that and rent and groceries. It's a lot to handle.
When he was president, my paycheck lasted to groceries, to put gas on my tank, and to save. Right now, forget it. I am living paycheck to paycheck, almost to the penny.
I had a lot more money when Trump was in. You know, I've been retired now for 12 years, and right now I'm just spending money on necessities. You know, that's not good for the economy. That hurts businesses.
We were averaging like $400 a month in groceries. It's closer to three times that now.
There are some U.S. voters. Ritika, when will consumers start to feel the benefit of that slowdown inflation, do you think?
Well, Sam, as we mentioned, the interest rate cut that the Fed has done, that takes time to filter through the economy and consumers. Now, even though price growth is now within that range of the Fed's 2% target, as you heard from those voters there, the sting of rapid price increases over the past 4 years, that is lingering for many consumers. And even if we look at the latest report, that core inflation, which excludes the volatile food and energy prices, that did actually climb month on month and came a little bit higher than expected. So consumers are feeling the pinch from everyday items like a gallon of milk that's risen so fast in a short amount of time, to housing costs that continue to put Americans at risk of seeing their standards of living fall. Okay. So that's what we see. Inflation and economy is a focal in the election.
Thank you very much, Ritika Gupta there, joining us from New York. And the burden of those higher prices has led some Americans to think twice about how much they spend on healthcare. The American Medical Association calculated that healthcare spending by US consumers reached $4.5 trillion in 2022. That's an average of $13,500 per person. Now, some people have saved money by having procedures in Mexico, as our reporter Viene Aldaete has been finding out.
I'm in El Paso, Texas, at the southern border of the United States, and I'm driving down to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, to visit two Mexican medical clinics that care for U.S. patients who cross into the country for medical services. This common practice is a benefit to those living in the U.S.-Mexico border region, the chance to visit a neighboring country to purchase medication and receive medical care at a fraction of the cost and all within a day. It's a partial solution to dealing with the cost of living reality for some Americans. Hola. Maribel Arámbula Montalvo is a dentist who has worked in Ciudad Juarez for 9 years and has U.S. patients make up about half of her total client base. She says that U.S. citizens decide to cross the border for dental treatment because they are declining the high costs of health services in the U.S.
The price might be double or even triple. Here, you can look at a filling for 800, 900 pesos. And in the U.S., it might be $300, $400.
With the current exchange rate being almost 20 Mexican pesos for every dollar, the economic impact of this practice is powerful, as medical clinics near international crossings can have U.S. patients make up 90% of their customers. However, in recent years, medics have been forced to turn down patients who seek to use their American insurance plans, as navigating U.S. insurance policy procedures has become more complicated.
A lot of my colleagues are preferring not to take insurance companies because it's way too much work and it ends up being very expensive for us.
This sentiment is understood by Americans who opt out of complicated U.S. insurances and seek services in Mexico instead. Ricardo Sanchez is a U.S. resident who has been traveling to Mexico for dental care since he was a child. He says he is discouraged about the upcoming U.S. presidential elections improving Americans' access to health care.
I believe it's going to be almost the same thing. The only person who has health insurance is the low income and the rich people. The medium class, most of the time, is a hard time to afford medical insurance.
Ricardo is uninsured and says he does not plan to seek care in the U.S. His previous experiences left him waiting for a medical appointment for months.
In Mexico, sometimes it's very easy to get an appointment and get a specialist right away. You need to wait probably just 1 week to get the appointment. In the U.S., it's going to take sometimes 6 months.
The cost of treatment can also be prohibitive when it comes to Americans looking after their pets. Ana Julia is a veterinary doctor and has owned an animal clinic in Ciudad Juarez for 20 years. About a fifth of her customer base is those crossing from the U.S. to Mexico.
La mayoría cruzan para encontrar un servicio especializado a un...
Most people cross to Mexico to find a specialized service at a lower price than in the United States. There really is no difference because veterinarians here in Mexico are just as qualified as those in the United States.
In August of this year, a new regulation implemented by the Centers for Disease Control complicated the process for cross-border movement of dogs. And Ana Julia says this has been problematic.
Ya piden microchip, ya perros menores de 6 meses.
They now ask for a microchip. Dogs under 6 months cannot cross. So I hope that with this new election, we can return to everybody being able to cross without so many problems.
Estivalis Leal is the owner of two French bulldogs and has a home in El Paso, Texas, in the U.S. and in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. She is aware of the new entry requirements for dogs. She hopes the upcoming election does not further complicate border crossings for her.
I feel like that's going to impact us in a way where maybe they're trying to control people or they're trying for us to spend more of our U.S. dollar over there instead of bringing your dog over here for a better price.
Estivalis lived away from the border for some years. She says she does not consider U.S. veterinarian services as an option for her pets due to the cost.
I used to live in San Antonio, Texas. We could only do American veterinarian services. A simple checkup could be up to $200. And here in Juarez, it's $50. It's a 4 times increase.
Despite possible inconveniences to come with whoever wins in November, people and their pets will continue to partake in cross-border trade in medical practices.
That was VNA Olda Ette reporting for us there. Now, the Spirit of Tasmania 4, a newly built ferry for the ocean crossing between mainland Australia and Tasmania, is to be docked more than 10,500 miles away in Edinburgh, in Scotland. The layup has been caused by a delay in the construction of a dock in Devonport in Tasmania. It means that the small port does not currently have a pier available that can fit the ferry. The terminal has been beset with delays and has caused much embarrassment. Here's Tasmania's Labour leader, Dean Winter, and head of the Chamber of Commerce, Michael Bailey.
Sending the Spirits to Singapore was a bad option. Having them sitting in the Derwent doing nothing is a bad option, and leasing them out to another country is a bad option. These are all bad options for our state.
It's more than just embarrassing. This is a calamity for Tasmania. It's one that we will be feeling for many generations to come.
Well, let's hear now from Adam Langenberg. He is the Tasmanian political reporter for Australian broadcaster ABC.
Main way is the Spirit of Tasmania is they take tourist caravans to and from the mainland and Tasmania, or lots of freight, and then also cars as well. It's the main way connecting Tasmania and really important to the tourism industry and all of those kind of things. So the existing vessels, which are called Spirit of Tasmania 2 and 3, they're nearing the end of their operational life. And there's only about room for 30% of it for caravans, which is one of the main ways that people bring their caravans over to Tasmania, or the only way. So the new vessels are supposed to be bigger and better. They're going to be 40% larger, and then they'll have capacity all through them for caravans, really important for tourists. So the tourism industry has been really, really excited. These vessels were supposed to arrive towards the end of this year. The first one, Spirit of Tasmania 4, is set to leave Rauma in Finland, where it's being constructed, by the end of next month. That's a big milestone for the project.
You've explained why these new ferries are so important. I think we can all understand that. But they're not going to arrive for another 3 years. So why? What's gone wrong?
This project to build these two new ferries has been a bit of a farce from the beginning, I suppose. There was initially a contract locked in for these two new ferries to arrive. I think it was supposed to be 2021. We were expecting these two new ferries. That contract was cancelled when the initial German boat builder went under, and there's been setback after setback with the project. But the biggest issue has been this port infrastructure that's supposed to be built in Devonport on the state's northwest coast. It was said to be built in August 2024, but it's become abundantly clear earlier this year that there's some delays with that project. The last we knew was early in 2026. And then we heard last week that that's been set back even further to February 2027 now.
And these delays have cost the economy something in the region of $350 million in lost revenue, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the annual estimation from economist Saul Weslake in Tasmania about what that's cost the local economy. So a really big blow. The problem with the bigger, better vessels is that they're longer and wider and need a berth different to the one that currently exists at Devonport and is used by the current Spirits. And that was well known.
And so Scotland is 10,500 miles away from Tasmania, and they're going to stay there until this berth is built.
No, we don't know that. So in the short term, Spirit of Tasmania 4 will sail there by the end of the month. What happens in the longer term, we don't know. The state government prefers the option of leasing out the ships, which requires finding a private operator who will use them in the short term between now and 2027. TT Line, which is the government business enterprise which owns the ships, they don't love that option. They prefer to store them in Scotland. In fact, they've highlighted Leith as their preferred option in Scotland going forward to store them there. But we just don't know at the moment. TT Line has engaged a broker to look at the options for leasing out the ships, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
That was Adam Langenberg speaking to us from Tasmania, and he is a reporter for ABC. Emma Wall is still with us. Projects like this will often come in over budget and late. But have you ever heard anything quite like this, Emma?
There's a book called How Big Things Get Done, which found last year that 91.5% of projects go over budget, over schedule, or both. So they're certainly not an anomaly, but the scale of this one does stand out. There's some big US projects that have also done similar, you know, infrastructure railways across the nation, also nuclear projects which have not been delivered, which obviously have other risks involved. But that 91.5% surprised me, but at least they're not alone.
It's the majority of build then. Thank you very much, Emma Wall, Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdowne. Thank you for joining us on World Business Report. And thank you to you for listening to the programme. The producer today was Neil Morrow. I'm Sam Fenwick. The team will be back same time tomorrow.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.